is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we explore how to survive the holiday season after bariatric surgery. But first, how best to help your loved ones age safely. Well, Thanksgiving and the holiday season are often a time when grown children visit parents or other older relatives and have an opportunity to see firsthand how their loved ones are getting along day to day. But what do you do if you discover that all is not as you thought it was? Well, here with the answer is Dr. Sharon Brangman, Professor of Medicine and the Division Chief for Geriatrics and the Director of the Central New York Alzheimer's Disease Assistance Center at Upstate Medical University. Dr. Brangman is also the past president of the American Geriatric Society. Welcome, Dr. Brangman. Thanks for coming
in. Thanks for inviting me.
So let's begin with that scenario that I just laid out. You live out of town and you're visiting for the holidays, and then you come home and you find some troubling signs. I mean, first, I guess, what would be the red flags that all is not well?
Well, it's actually a very common scenario. You have conversations over the phone, and a lot of older people know the right things to say. And so, in normal conversation, everything seems fine. But when you get to the home, you might find that the place is not clean. There may be broken windows or doors or other things. I had one family where there was a mouse infestation and nothing was really being done about it. The refrigerator was empty. The elderly mother in this case was wearing dirty clothes with big holes in it and just looked dirty and disheveled. So that was a hint that even though she said everything was fine on the telephone, when they saw her, they realized it was really out of control.
If it isn't so blatant, obviously that's pretty blatant. I mean, you're looking at something that the person you thought or you knew to be a certain way is clearly looking very different in terms of their self-care and all of that. But if it's not quite as obvious as that, and yet you're getting kind of a funny feeling in your tummy that the person isn't quite as sharp as they were. Are there some kinds of tests? I mean, you know, I don't mean to make it sound too clinical, but are there things that you could try to really assess whether they're still as sharp and able to take care of themselves as they were?
Well, you might see that mail is piling up and that things are maybe not getting paid, or you can make a conversation about the mail and that sort of thing. But a lot of times people know the right answers, and it can be very hard for a family member to discern what's going on. I had another example where the meal preparation just wasn't on par. And this was someone who used to be known for making pies, and everything was a little off. And to someone who may not know that person well, they may think things are okay, but this person knew that her mother was just not performing to the right level. So the first thing that has to be done if you have a suspicion or even a hint of concern is to get a good assessment. And it can be hard for a family member to make that assessment because you have all the emotional tugs and pulls and everything else going on. So you really need an objective person to help you get the right information.
So that's really the place to start. If you have any suspicion, it sounds to me like that the person is not functioning. If you have any suspicion that the person is not functioning at the level that they once did, you really need a professional to come in and help you figure that out.
Correct.
But if you're coming in from out of town, where would you begin generally to do that? Would you contact, for example, their doctor, their local doctor?
So the first step is to get an appointment with their primary care physician. And now a lot of this is not going to happen within that short time frame of a long weekend for Thanksgiving, for example, or another holiday, but that's the first step. And it also depends if what you see seems to be at the emergency level or the potential of being life-threatening. And if that's the case, then you might have to go to an emergency room or something of that nature to escalate it to a higher level. But if it looks like there's no immediate life-threatening issue, then you would want to make contact with the primary care physician, a good geriatric assessment, and hopefully have a chance to speak to the healthcare provider beforehand so that some of your concerns can get expressed. Because also we find that when an older person goes to the doctor, they often rise to the occasion and they can put on a good face. And families often get frustrated, especially if they can't be there, because then their mother or father might say, oh, everything is fine. The doctor says it's okay. And you find out they omitted large parts of critical information.
That the person themselves did, or perhaps the if the physician isn't trained in a geriatric assessment, might miss some key points.
Right, it could be both. It could be both. So most older people may overestimate their ability to continue to manage themselves when they get into their upper 80s and beyond.
That makes most sense, though, especially if they've been independent-minded. It's hard to be self-evaluative, I would think, especially if your memory's failing or you're failing cognitively. It's even more difficult, I think.
It's very true. So it's often the adult child or another relative who has to bring in that perspective.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Sharon Brangman, and we're talking about how best to help our aging loved ones age safely. So let's say you've taken them, and perhaps you've had a successful evaluation. The doctor has been successful in figuring out, well, they're doing okay, basically, but there are some indications that something is slipping here. How do you then, what are the steps or the criteria to determine whether that person should continue to live on their own, and how safe can they be?
Well, the way that we break it down in our office is we have to look at cognitive or brain function and then physical function. So let's assume for the moment that their brain and their thinking is working out okay. And so we have to look at physical function, and that's really the core of geriatric medicine. So we divide things up into two categories: instrumental activities of daily living and basic activities of daily living. And the instrumental activities of daily living are the things that you do to interact with the world around you. Those are things like going to the bank, paying bills, keeping track of your taxes and your money.
Going grocery shopping,
cooking, keeping the house clean, keeping track of appointments and social activities, taking medications, and driving. So we like to first evaluate the older adult's ability to handle the instrumental activities of daily living. If they're having difficulty in any of those areas, those are usually services that can be added on frequently in the home setting. They can also be done in an assisted living care setting. So that is the first order, is to figure out exactly what problems are they having. And in our office, for instance, we like to look at medications because the medications tend to pile up as you get older.
Pile up in what way?
We tend to take more and more pills as we get older. And the regimen of keeping those straight can be very confusing.
At any age.
So one of the first things we want to do is look at that medication list and see if we can simplify it to make it as easy as possible for that older person to maintain the ability to keep track of it. And sometimes the medicine was started years ago and nobody knows why. Some of the medicines may be causing someone to be a little muddled in their thinking or have other side effects that weren't there initially. So we often start with medications. And then we have to look and see what other things are problematic. Is it driving? Is that person having trouble remembering the rules of the road or getting from one place to another?
That's a big elephant in the room.
That is a huge, huge issue because our society is so car-focused, and especially if you live in the suburbs.
In central New York,
you cannot get around.
To get around without a vehicle.
We don't have a subway. We don't have, extensive bus service. So we have to look and see, Are there services that need to be brought into the home because that person isn't able to go out and access them anymore? Do they need someone to help supervise their bills? There are services that can do that. So first we have to see what category of physical function is impaired.
I have a question for you here, though. You were mentioning the two types. One was instrumental activities. What was the other?
The other one is basic. And the basic activities of daily living are all the things that we all personally need to do to get through the day. And that includes dressing, bathing, maintaining your hygiene, getting to the toilet.
So those would be feeding, even, those would be even on a higher level of priority in terms of if the person cannot complete those things in terms of making your decision as to whether they could stay alone.
Exactly. So if somebody cannot walk, that's another basic activity of daily living. If they cannot keep themselves clean, get to the bathroom, on and off the toilet, that raises it to a level of urgency. And usually when people have deficits in those areas, they need a higher level of care. Either they need someone in their home for most of the day, sometimes 24 hours a day, or else they need to be in a facility where that care can be given to them. So that's why it's important. This is a very individual decision because it's based on the needs of that person. It's not always a one-size-fits-all. So it really needs to be assessed on an individual basis.
And those decisions that are made clearly have to reflect exactly where that person is at, as well as perhaps what resources can be made available to them. I mean, if you live in an environment or a part of even this region where some of those support services are not available, you might be forced, in a sense, to seek an institutional setting.
So that's exactly right. And a lot of it depends on the services that are available as well as the person's finances, because that is a big driver of some of these decisions. And it also depends how well brain function is. So if in the course of a geriatric assessment, which includes a memory evaluation, we might find that somebody has problems making good decisions, remembering things that are important, and then we may have to take even another route to add on support for decline in brain function.
Right, and both medically as well as through behavioral interventions of various kinds.
Correct.
Or assistance of some kind.
Correct.
Right. There's just so much here. I guess the point that you made, though, I think is so crucial, which is you probably can't solve this if you're visiting from out of town over a short weekend or even a week, but you could at least begin a process of hooking up your loved one with an appropriate assessment circumstance, and then from there begin to make decisions as you move along.
That's correct. So no, none of this has a quick solution. It takes a lot of planning and time and connecting with the right resources.
This is Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen, and if you are just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Sharon Brangman, Professor of Medicine and the Division Chief for Geriatrics at Upstate Medical University. And we're talking about how best to assess your aging relative's ability to remain either safely at home or how to make the difficult decision to find an alternative living circumstance. So before the break, we were discussing how important it is to have a good assessment as the basis for figuring these things out. But once you know kind of what their abilities are, both intellectually and physically, how do you make a choice in terms of, again, the home, you've kind of said that before, but then whether you can find an assisted living, an appropriate assisted living circumstance, or even a nursing home. What are the criteria?
Well, it starts to become a matter of preference and also of finances. Most people prefer to be in their own home, and that's the goal. We try to work with that as much as possible, but it's not always possible. There are a number of home services that can be brought into the home, and it also depends if the caregiver is local or not. If the caregiver or the adult child is out of town, it can be very hard to keep track of all the moving pieces and decisions that are needed to help coordinate a loved one's life from a distance. And so you might
need, whether they're at home or in an assisted living or nursing home.
So it begins to be a decision on how much that caregiver can provide support. And if they want someone to help them, for instance, a geriatric care manager, I kind of call them like rent-a-daughter. It's a professional who knows all of the resources and can help with a lot of those day-to-day decisions for a certain charge. It's very helpful if somebody is out of town and can't be there, but it's also helpful in town.
How does one find someone like that? I've never really heard of that.
There's a number of referral sources. The Office of Aging here in Onondaga County. There are a number of places where you can find someone who can help you bridge that gap and fill in the right services.
You mentioned the Onondaga County Department of Aging and Youth. I know they have a caregiver resource center, and I know they have a wealth of information. We'll have a link on our website to them so that you can make contact with them.
They're an excellent resource. So if you want to do this on your own, in a lot of ways, that caregiver becomes their own charge nurse and their own nursing home administrator. And so then they would have to coordinate the people who are coming in and out of the house to help set up services.
That's if it's at home. That includes things like drivers, people to perhaps take them grocery shopping, spend time with them, make sure they take their medicines, all of the things that would be required.
So exactly. So it could be a companion, a home health aide, it could be registered nurses, it could be visiting nurses. It depends on what services tend to be needed for that person. And an assisted living environment, which we have a number of excellent facilities in this area, is usually paid for by cash. And you rent an apartment, and there can be communal meals. So meals are often in a dining room. You can add on additional services if somebody needs help with medications, or if somebody needs help getting the day started, or maybe getting ready for bed at night. All of those services can be added. So you can go anywhere from being completely independent, where you're essentially just renting a room, to needing extra care.
But what are the benefits then when you say renting a room? Basically, you're living independently, but you have perhaps transportation provided. Should you want to go grocery shopping yourself, I mean, as the individual, you will have that added. You have the opportunity of socialization.
So in an assisted living environment, they provide a lot of those services that are in the instrumental activities of daily living category. So that means there may be buses and transportation for grocery shopping, errands, social events. There is often a community environment there so that there are different activities that come in. Most assisted livings have a home-like environment so that they feel more homey and less institutional.
And someone might be there to oversee your medications, or at least that you're taking your medications, that kind of thing.
So you can pay for those extra services. However, an assisted living environment does not have a nurse on duty, and there are no doctors on duty.
So it's not truly a medical
facility. So it's not a medical setting. It's more of a living social environment. You can build in certain other levels of care.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Sharon Brangman. We're talking about how best to help an aging loved one assure their safety as they age and where they can find that. So what about nursing homes? Why would you choose a nursing home?
Well, a nursing home is usually chosen for people who have problems with the basic activities of daily living. These are often people with some degree of dementia or cognitive impairment, problems thinking and making good decisions for themselves. And they may need help with walking, getting to the toilet, getting dressed, etc. Or else they have medical problems that need to be supervised on a daily basis, because in a nursing home, there are nurses available 24 hours a day, and there are physicians that come in on a regular basis. So unlike an assisted living environment, a nursing home really has a medical environment, so that the medical care is woven into the other services that are provided.
So those, it sounds to me like that's pretty much the single most important criteria as to which you might choose, and also the issue of mentation, how clearly you're thinking, or whether you have the added problem of dementia.
Correct. That's right. Exactly right.
So you've decided. So you've decided that it's time to step in, and you want to make some change in your loved one's living circumstance. How do you begin that conversation with dignity? I mean, and how do you then, if you have other family members, siblings, for example, or other relatives who would be involved, how do you get them involved?
So this is the hard work of it, because these are tough discussions, and it often involves a degree of role reversal where children are now helping parents after a lifetime of parents helping children. The ideal situation is to start to have these conversations before there's a big crisis or an issue, so then you can start to have things organized and you can be sure you're following the wishes of your parents or your relatives. That's not always possible, because a lot of parents are reluctant to have these conversations and to give up some level of control over their lives, because that's just not the way we operate. You know, we spend our whole lives developing this level of independence. But there comes a point where everyone needs help. And in the case of multiple children, it's often important to make sure that everyone has a certain role. So this can be very hard to organize, because a lot of emotional issues often come out, and a lot of family
dynamics.
Discussions and dynamics can be very hard to navigate. Some people do very well if they have a social worker or a mediator or someone else to help them kind of set the goals of care and talk about what needs to be done.
I would think that's especially true of people who are living out of town. If you have someone in Idaho and someone in California and someone perhaps in New York State, it might be helpful to have a third party to mediate the conversation.
Sometimes that's very helpful, because for the most part, everybody would like to help and pitch in, but they have different abilities to do so. And a lot of guilt comes in, and a lot of other issues.
Resentment, I would think, for the local child.
So the local child who's here and sees it day to day, and then the other people who don't. So as I mentioned, a lot of dynamics come in, and sometimes some professional assistance is very helpful. So there might be one child, for instance, who manages the finances and sets up things online and keeps track of that, and another one who coordinates the medical care and the visits, and another one that works on medications or refills or something. So everyone needs to have a role and the ability to pitch in according to what they can do.
That sounds ideal. Unfortunately, in many families, that doesn't seem to be the case. I'll also add that I know the Department of Aging and Youth here in Onondaga County has a caregiver resource center, which I've alluded to, and they do offer mediation help. So that's something to know for our listeners in this region.
Yeah, they're a very good resource. And there's also a number of geriatric social workers and other people who can help families with this.
Well, it seems to me this whole notion, though, of dignity. I mean, you just might have a problem where the person isn't yet ready to drive. I mean, that in and of itself is a huge conversation, knowing when to take the keys away. How do you as a physician see that happening? And what do you see as the major red flag there?
Well, the driving issue is very, very sensitive. But you might come home and notice that there are dents in the car that there is no explanation for. Or you may be driving with your parent and you feel very uncomfortable because they're just not using good judgment, following speed limits or the rules of the road. So here's the tough discussion, because in terms of the Department of Motor Vehicles, you can renew your license just through the mail.
Which is frightening.
Which is very much a concern. Yeah. So, as a family member, you have to start the conversation. And we would have to help identify other resources to start to fill in those gaps.
So I want to make sure that you'll provide us with a number of resources that we will link to on our website, because obviously so much of this is going to be resource dependent. Even if you are here as a child or as a relative of an aging person, you still need help besides yourself.
So, this is not something you innately know how to do. And the first time you confront it, it can seem very overwhelming. However, what adult children should know out there is that this is a very common problem, and we happen to be in a very resource-rich part of the state, so that there are lots of solutions out there.
And there are people trained in geriatrics, such as yourself, so that's also very reassuring, because it really is kind of a subspecialty at
this
point.
Our office is pretty unique in this area, because we are the only group that services older adults primarily, and we have a team with nurses, social workers, nurse practitioners, and we all know some of these issues, and we can help connect people to the right resources.
We'll also have a link to your particular, or do you have a phone number people can call?
Yes, it's 464-6100.
And that's area code 315.
315.
Very good. Well, how do you think, what do you see in just the little bit of time we have left as the major challenge for our generation going forward? I've heard it said many times, the question being asked, well, who will take care of us? Because there are, in the baby boomer population, such a disproportionate number of people, and the younger population is smaller. So what do you think of that?
Well, that is a very big concern, because the number of medical students choosing geriatrics, the number of nursing students choosing gerontological nursing is very small. However, you have to start planning and think ahead now. You cannot wait for a crisis. So I always urge adult children to start thinking about what they would like as they get older. And sometimes when they see what they're dealing with their parents, that triggers that need to start the planning process.
Wonderful advice. Well, my guest has been Dr. Sharon Brangman, Professor of Medicine and the Division Chief for Geriatrics and the Director of the Central New York Alzheimer's Disease Assistance Center at Upstate Medical University. Dr. Brangman is also the past president of the American Geriatric Society. Thanks so much once again for coming in. It's always so informative and a delight to
talk
with you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Social support keeps us living longer and happier, or honking from the heart. Well, folks, for a long time, researchers have known that those of us who have what is technically called social support, that is, good relationships with family, friends, colleagues, feel better about our lives and are less likely to develop some physical maladies and, on average, live longer. The flip side is also true. Those of us who are socially isolated are less happy, more likely to get sick, and to die sooner. A new study showed that social isolation is very powerful, a more powerful predictor of premature death than high blood pressure, wow, and about as bad as smoking, double wow. Just how do we make that social support then happen in our lives? Well, when I was about 10 years old, I was standing on the front steps of our house with my dad. It was a nippy, crackling, beautiful fall day. Me wearing my favorite gray and red and orange and green plaid wool jacket, I can still feel it, with one hand stuffed in a pocket and the other in his big hand. Just then, the honk, honk, honking of a small flock of geese flying overhead. My dad looked up and so I did too. And he, who was not prone to sentimental statements, talked about how the geese reminded him of being a boy back home in Ireland with his family. And that touched his heart. And he looked in my eyes and his heart touched my heart. For the first time, I thought of him as a young boy with his own mom and dad and felt how he felt loved by them. Since that special moment, whenever I hear the geese, I flash back to us on those steps and hear his voice and feel his love, like a memory hug. These days, it feels like the first goose I hear honking is actually my dad come back as a goose honking to me, telling me of how much he loved me and loves me still. My heart melts, and even as I'm saying this, I can feel my body relax and my heart slow down, and I have an I feel loved smile coming across my face. That memory also connects me to his mom and dad, and even though I never met them, from that moment on, I knew they loved me too. And I still feel warm and hugged by that knowing all the way across the miles and miles of ocean and the many, many years. Of course, what I've been and am still trying to do with my wife and our two now grown sons and hopefully someday grandkids is open my heart like my dad that day and send the forever message that supports a long and happy life. Honk. Honk, honk, my dear ones, I love you. I'm Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next up, the holidays can be a real challenge for all of us, but coming up, we'll explore how to survive them after bariatric surgery. And don't forget to stay with us for our visit from the Healing Muse. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for November 25th. Think small, save big. The size of our plate plays a large role in how much we eat. Studies have shown that the bigger the container, the more we are likely to consume. The bottom of the bowl is a useful mental cue for us to stop eating and check if we're full. Turns out, smaller portions can be just as satisfying. This week, enjoy your meals on a salad plate or in a small bowl. If eating food out of a package, put it on a plate first. This simple step can make all the difference in calories consumed. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Thanksgiving and dreams of turkey and all the trimmings. But holiday dinners after bariatric surgery are hard for anyone, regardless if it's your first one or you are years post-op. And here with some helpful insights on how best to survive them is Jessica Planer, a registered dietitian that specializes in the care of surgical bariatric patients in the bariatric surgery program at Upstate Medical University. Welcome.
Hi, Linda.
Nice to see you. So gone are the days of piling your plate high and doing it twice around, I guess. It must be a challenge to these folks, as it is really for all of us during the holidays.
Well, I think the decision to have bariatric surgery is a challenging one for all. Most patients, it's their last resort. They've tried several methods of weight loss, and they just haven't had this success. So when it comes to making this decision, they really have vested a lot of time and energy in doing this.
So there's a lot at stake, I guess, having gone through a major surgical procedure, and now you're faced with the temptations of Thanksgiving, right?
Of course, patients, you know, some patients struggle more than others. We at our program have not one but two dietitians and a multidisciplinary team that really works with the patient to help them understand what this journey is going to be like, both, you know, before surgery and after surgery. So we help prepare them so when they make this decision and have their operation that holidays and other events that surround food are not so challenging, and they can get through it successfully and keeping, you know, their goals in mind and hopefully meeting their goals of healthy living.
So help us understand, what exactly are the guidelines for the bariatric patient right after surgery? Let's say they would have had the surgery within a month or two of a holiday coming up.
Sure. We have plenty of patients that are actually getting operated on right before, the day before Thanksgiving, and
wow.
I always congratulate them on their endeavor and their strength. They are given very clear guidelines on their diet after surgery, and because of the swelling in the stomach area where the surgeon will manipulate to make a very small pouch, we ask that they are on a liquid diet, actually.
So that's immediately after.
Exactly.
Does that last up, let's say, several months later?
Oh, no. It's only for about 5 to 7 days, and then they're allowed to eat some soft foods. We provide them with two medicine cups of in their hospital bag, and for, you know, the average person, that's going to be about the size of a NyQuil bottle top. That's how much they're going to be able to eat. We provide the tool, and they're allowed to put soft foods into those cups.
So that's immediately after surgery.
Yes.
And I would think that's not the majority of people we're talking about. Some people do face that. But how about if you're within 3, 4, 5 months and it is your first Thanksgiving?
Sure.
What are the dietary guidelines
sure.
there?
The patient then, once they reach about 6 weeks post-op, they're able to go to a regular diet. We encourage low-fat foods and no sweets allowed for a while. At 6 to 8 weeks post-op, they really are taught to be structured in their eating. They're generally eating 3 meals a day, and they're protein-based meals.
You say structured, does that mean it's planned?
Do you require
them to really kind of write out meal plans, know what they're going to eat before they sit down?
Exactly. If they can do that, we will do that for them if needed. We encourage, again, the 3 meals a day. Protein always consume first. In case they do feel the fullness, they don't want to fill up on the carbohydrates. They need that protein for maximal weight loss and to spare their muscle, since they're eating very little calories. So we always encourage liquids in between their meals. They don't drink with meals after bariatric surgery. We encourage them to stop drinking 30 minutes before their meal and start 30 minutes after.
And that's interesting. Why is that?
Well, the thought is that in the long run, the fluid may be pushing the food through the small pouch, and patients that come back struggling with weight loss in the years to come will often say that they're drinking with their meal and not feeling the signs of fullness that they once felt early on.
So it kind of, in a way, I don't say undoes the effect of surgery, but it undoes the feeling
of the fullness. That's
exactly. So interesting. Okay, so how does that impact, given the enticements of the holidays? What do you tell your patients before, let's assume they're well after surgery, within 6 months of surgery?
Sure.
What do you tell them when they're going to go to a holiday meal?
Well, I encourage them to never go hungry to a holiday meal, because if you're hungry, you tend to want to overeat. So I encourage the patient to try to eat normally the day of the holiday event, meaning they don't skip breakfast and they consume a healthy lunch. And when they get to the party, evaluate their environment. Where's the food? Is the food all over, or is the food in one specific location? I encourage my patient not to stand near the food table. That may help them eat a little less. I always encourage them to be drinking fluids, a fluid that would be calorie-free, preferably water, during the event as well.
So that's, once again, in an effort to have them eat less quantity or exactly. be tempted to eat less quantity because they would feel full.
Exactly. We have to remember with bariatric surgery, the point of the operation is to help patients feel full at a meal on a very small amount of food. But if the patient tends to graze, meaning they're eating in an inappropriate setting over a long period of time, my patients call it snacking or picking. That may defeat the purpose of the operation. The pouch doesn't work well for the patient at that time. So the grazing is generally what we hear patients state when they may be struggling with their weight loss. So we definitely encourage structure. And at holiday gatherings, I encourage them to look for healthier choices. And make sure that they're eating their protein first.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Jessica Planer. She's a registered dietitian, and we're talking about how to survive holiday meals after you've had bariatric surgery. So you've given us some very good ideas. What about alcohol? How does alcohol play a role?
Sure.
Because it's so tempting during the holidays.
Yeah. Generally, we encourage our patients, if they're a year or less post-op, to not drink any alcohol until we can make sure the laboratory's assessment is all okay. When we're, a bariatric patient, we're, in the beginning only eating about 300 calories to 500, and we have to supplement with vitamins to stay
balanced and healthy.
Exactly. So, alcohol can contribute to vitamin deficiencies. So we definitely encourage them to, not have any type of alcohol for at least a year.
Also strikes me from what little I know is that sometimes when you drink alcohol, you become less inhibited
or
disinhibited, yes. And you might be hungrier
right.
or eat more.
Exactly.
Is that your experience as well?
I agree. Patients will tend to overeat or snack more if they're drinking. We also, as the years go on, we do talk about alcohol. We encourage, non-carbonated beverages. And if you've had a gastric bypass, we certainly encourage to avoid any consequences. We encourage, a drier wine of some sort, and not alcohol or a wine that would be high in sugar.
Okay.
But we definitely will work with the patient to make it reasonable if they have, the desire to have one drink moderately. We will talk to them about what's the best choice. And again, it should be a year or two out of surgery.
So you had said actually at one point that after a year or two after surgery, the bariatric patient looks very much like any patient who's trying to, in a sense, keep their weight down in terms of what they're eating. So what kinds of recommendations, in other words, what food situations pose the biggest problem, and what do you recommend as far as coping?
Well, what I teach my patients is to identify situations where they may, overeat or put themselves in a situation where they will, overeat, and evaluate where their coping strategies. So, for example, if a patient is a sweet eater and likes sweets and in the past has, had a binge or disorder.
Fallen off
sweets.
The wagon
exactly.
with sweets.
Is it smart for her to sign up to bring the bake goods? Or maybe she could ask a family member, I'm not going to bake this year. Could you bake? And I will wrap all the presents. So that way she's removed herself from the situation of possibly abusing the sweets or the food item that she doesn't control well.
It's helpful to know kind of what foods are going to be served at the event, I think. And then what you're suggesting is maybe engage in activities that would, in a sense, take you away
Absolutely.
A little bit from being
Absolutely.
Tempted constantly.
Absolutely. I always talk to my patients about, embracing the family and not fixating on the food, playing games or talking about recent events is always helpful. Again, making sure that they go with a plan in mind and know what's served and be a role model and bring a healthy dish. And,
that's a great idea.
Exactly. And I also talk about recipe modification, how we can make high fat recipes or high fat foods, lower fat or less sugar content.
So if you're, let's say either you're the patient or someone in your family is is giving the meal, whether you're the patient's giving them the Thanksgiving meal or, a family member is, what kinds of recommendations would you say to the people preparing the meal in terms of the kinds of foods to offer that would be helpful to all?
Right. I talk to my patients about communicating with their family. Not everyone in the family have had bariatric surgery, and some patients may be able to eat more of a certain food than others. But the bariatric patient needs to keep a line of communication open with their family and ask that maybe certain foods are made in a healthy manner.
So generally, are you saying low fat is important? High protein is important? What
sure.
else is important?
Yeah, and getting your carbohydrates from your fruits and vegetables. So, always having, a few servings of vegetables at the table and a variety of different lean proteins.
Generally, this is a small thought I had in terms of portion control. Is it generally better for that kind of circumstance to have your plates prepared in advance, a full plate versus the family style dinner where everything is laid out and you can help yourself to as much as you want?
Yeah, the research has shown that if food is sitting in front of patients, they will tend to eat more. So I do encourage my patients to pre-portion their plate and use smaller utensils and smaller plates, exactly. I don't think that having food in front of a patient is a good thing. I think the patients will eat more, as the research and as the patient has said to me in the past.
Should all bariatric surgery patients remain in contact with a good registered dietitian, and for how long?
Absolutely. We at Upstate, definitely stay in touch with our patients. We see them frequently, especially that first year. We see them every 3 months, and we usually touch base at least yearly or more. Again, we have two dietitians that that work closely with our patients to make sure that they stay on track and that they're meeting their weight loss goals and not regaining that weight and staying healthy.
Sounds great. All I can say is I wish them luck and all of us luck as the holidays approach, because we're all challenged during those times. My guest has been Jessica Planer, a registered dietitian that specializes in the care of the surgical bariatric patient in the bariatric surgery program at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Linda.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse. I'd like to read an excerpt from Rich Kempa's essay, Nothing Between Us Now But Love. In this piece, Rick is taking a short road trip with his mother, who is in the beginning stages of Alzheimer's. The son rejoices in this time he has with his mother. Nothing between us now but love. My mother and I are working our way down to Moab, where I will be leaving her in the care of my brother. A road trip with her is a risky thing. In motion, she can become as unmoored as any poor creature in the universe and as desperate. Now the thoughts are roiling through me. Today, she is not the burden we have let her become in the time that she's been a member of our house. She is not a responsibility that weighs on me. She is not, forgive me, the fretful woman whose continual repetitions I learn to ignore or divert or even at my worst, rebuke. She is, on this afternoon of wondrous clarity, an old friend sharing a journey on the most beautiful road in the world. I am flooded with a warmth for her of a kind that I do not remember ever feeling, and I think, let me pay as close attention to this day as I can. Let me imprint it forever. Mom, I tell her, it may well be that you will forget this afternoon, but I don't want you to worry, because I'm going to remember it for both of us. Her hand reaches over and clasps my sleeve, and her voice rings with relief. Oh, would you please? That would mean so much. I promise, I say, and it's a long time before she lets go. I look at her, perched on the bumper beside me, her white hair jutting out beneath the baseball cap, a black vest pulled up around her neck, her eyes gleaming behind those dark glasses. She takes a tiny sip of the beer that I pass to her, licks her lips, passes it back. I realize that I am as content as I have ever been. Come what may, there is nothing between us now but love, just as it was at the beginning.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's Health Link on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we learn about kids who need kidney dialysis and all about the medical value of marijuana, plus how to get through the holidays if you're grieving. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it by going on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.